Hi, I'm a theoretical physicist by training. I was at Bell Labs for about 10 years, and then I've been at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory for another 14 years now. And I've sort of been mapping brain circuits. That's kind of what my main research topic is. But I've re-engaged in machine learning because I was working on that, and wet brains, dry brains, one has to kind of understand them together. So I'm one of those theoretical physicist who has an experimental biology lab. There are a few. So as you know, there's been a lot of certainly dollars flowing into so-called deep networks. One thing people, I don't know, people realize is that this is of course an old field. In fact, the first kind of certifiable deep network was published by a Ukrainian control theorist in the 1960s. Nobody cites this work, a few people cite this work, gentleman by the name of Ivakhnenko. I'm not gonna really talk about it, but I just want to say that there's a lot of excitement, but a lot of need for scholarship, is, let me put it this way. So if you look in the world of these so-called deep networks or artificial neural networks, there's essentially a zoo. There's been this kind of evolutionary explosion, Cambrian explosion. There's lots of kinds of creatures, and people invent these, and then they try to say that mine is better than yours. It won a competition. Give me so many millions of dollars, and that's kind of how it is going right now. And not a lot of theoretical understanding. There's of course growing theoretical understanding, a lot of heuristics. People who are experts at it know how to tune the learning parameters. How to do the stochastic gradient descent and so on and so forth. But there's sort of need for theory. And I was interested to see, in fact, Google CEO blogging on this and saying that Google's answer to this is AutoML, which is, and there was this somewhat, purple prose from New York Times saying building AI that can build AI. So these were able to learn the networks themselves. Of course, biology already has AutoML. By the way, some people made impolite remarks about AutoML, about it's just parameter tuning glorified. So I encourage you to Google AutoML, I suppose. But biology already has something like this. It's called evolution. You try out circuits, it doesn't work, doesn't propagate. And so what I would and I don't want to use these words loosely, because I think people use words like computation, algorithm, learning very loosely. I think it really hurts. There was a mathematician philosopher at MIT who pointed out that these words we use, like the Greeks use the words water, earth, fire, air. One should really discard these words to stick to the math while we understand what's going on, and then re-engage. But with that kind of apologia, I will be using these sorts of words. And so in some sense, the brain circuits are nature's algorithms, if you want. Wouldn't it be nice to actually map the circuits out, study what the circuits are, and then see what nature's algorithms are? And that's kind of what I've been engaged in, now many years. I'm doing it in mouse at Cold Spring Harbor, and in the marmoset monkey at in Japan. I have a lab in Tokyo. And this is at the so-called mesoscopic scale, which is what inner anatomists have classically done by injecting tracers. I'm not going to talk about this today, but please ask me if you're interested. I can show you. I spend a lot of time on that. There are other efforts mapping circuits at a finer scale using electron microscopy and so on. But that's the study of, if you want, nature circuits. But one can also study circuits in engineering, and it's really the study of distributed, I would emphasize the word distributed, algorithms. And so I've been looking into that with a colleague here at UCSB. In fact, Bassam Bamier, been looking at distributed control theory, and with a colleague, Anirban Sengupta at Rutgers, not yet quite gotten to the distributed part, but looking at machine learning, and another colleague, Michel Belkin. And the idea, of course, is that compare the two, ask if the same principles and patterns recur in these two cases. One we didn't make, one we think we made. I I would say we discovered. And if there are common things, then those might be, if you want, quote unquote, the laws of intelligence. So this is the so-called computationalist perspective. And some people think that's a good idea, some people think it's not a good idea, think it's a hypothesis. My particular focus is the whole brain or the whole nervous system. And so I gravitate to what is the overall architecture of the system. So not so much the microarchitecture, but how the whole thing is put together. If you make a robot, the whole thing has to move about, navigate in the environment. Look at the brain, it's got, you know, many different parts there hooked together in a particular way. And if you look at a particular chunk of the brain, maybe it's doing something. If you can say that a particular chunk of the brain is doing something, but then how is the whole thing put together? And one thing I would note is, you know, I kind of started doing some of this when I was at Bell, and then I sort of left that and started studying engineering subjects because I convinced myself that one really needs to understand how human engineers build systems that have quote-unquote purpose. So biologists often talk about function. If you look in the dictionary meaning of function, it means purpose. Well, and you know, in science there's no purpose, of course, but evolution has kind of, if you want some notion of well, biologists call it function, you know, this whole philosophical discussion I'm not gonna go into here. But so studying these engineering theories, but then more recently physics has sort of struck back in machine learning and AI, and it's all about kind of numerical linear algebra. And the computer scientists are basically doing, in some sense, what physicists have been doing earlier in a different context. And you know, continuum math has been kind of taking revenge on discrete math in computer science. So, of course, computer science is based on computer languages, and of course, computer languages were kind of very discrete, you know, very different from vector spaces. But lo and behold, now people are representing words as vectors in some high-dimensional space, and the sentence is a random walk in that high-dimensional abstract space. Meaning is somehow locality in that high-dimensional space, a very kind of physics-y way of looking at things. Not clear the brain does anything like that, maybe it does, who knows, but sort of very different from the way traditionally computer scientists have approached that problem. Linearization by lifting to high-dimensional spaces is a very kind of widespread concept in machine learning, and that's of course well known to physicists. Those of you who know about Koopman linearization, which is basically kind of linearizing classical mechanics by converting into partial differential equations. And I just was at the NIPS meeting and I saw Koopman engineers have been using Koopman linearization, but that's even appeared in machine learning now. Group theory, not yet clear how much of a role group theory is going to play, but in machine learning, translational invariance was maybe discovered again, and it's called convolutional networks. So this is very big thing, and it's translational invariance. Okay, so group theory is playing some role. How much of a role it is playing remains to be seen. People like Stefan Mallard think it's playing a large role. You know, some other people think it's not playing such a large role. Which symmetries? But symmetries can impose some structure on the algorithms. The one that, you know, I've kind of been intrigued by quite a bit in the subject of this talk is what I call thermodynamics of big data. And in physics parlance, phase transitions, math parlance, concentration of measure, basically doing very high dimensional integrals. And when one starts doing very, very high dimensional integrals or sums, some simplicities appear, and particularly in the engineering context, one can get what one might call performance phase transition. So system works, it doesn't work, and in between there's a sharp boundary. It's not like it's a gradual fail. If a tiger is about to eat you, you don't gradually decide it's a tiger. You kind of know it's a tiger and you run. If you don't, there's a problem. That algorithm doesn't survive. So this is just a little elaboration. I'll probably skip over this, but how many of you are familiar with word vectors and analogies by using word vectors? So not a lot, not everyone. So I'm just going to tell you, people have played the following kind of game. So you represent words by vectors, and so you have to find out which word corresponds to which vector. I'm not going to tell you how you do that, but let's say you have some way of doing that. Then you say that, you know, let's say, man is to woman as king is to what? And then you solve that word analogy by minimizing this over all possible vectors, this quantity, and you find the result becomes queen. The word vector for queen comes up, right? So that's kind of the word vector analogy. So somehow high dimensional vector spaces are, you know, at least a pragmatically useful way of dealing with language. And that kind of purple prose article in New York Times I pointed to you about was basically about word vector representations being used in Google Translate and, you know, how that had improved performance and so on and so forth. Not clear how much it has improved performance, but it's perfect, but that's, so Koopman linearization, again, if you have some nonlinear decision problem, let's say in two dimensions, there is no line that will separate the blue and the red dots, but by lifting the blue dot up in one dimension, now you can pass a plane that will separate the blue and the red dots. And so a nonlinear decision problem on a variable X is converted into a linear decision problem by taking functions of that vector X, and then doing linear regression. I'm not gonna elaborate on this. So Stefan Mallet has been trying to argue that, for example, for machine vision, not just translational invariance, but let's say some degree of scale invariance, you know, certainly rotational invariance. I found some years ago, I was like puzzled, like why people are not putting in rotational invariance. Then 1 year I go to this meeting, Google has discovered rotational invariance. They're rotating their filters by four, you know, 90. There's a whole paper on this, right? So, but this is the one that, you know, I've kind of been interested in. I should say that, you know, my talk won't have a lot of heavy lifting in terms of math in it. This is kind of an ideas talk. Not so interested in the heavy lifting on the mathematics side at the moment. just trying to get kind of the big picture in my own research. You know, if I'm going to think about the brain and think about, you know, sets of neurons as doing something, you know, what is it that it is doing? Why does it have a particular architecture? The problem has to be posed first properly. I don't think these problems have been posed well. So I'm kind of remaining at this somewhat higher level. I mean, ultimately one does have to do calculations and, you know, getting into some of that as well. So modern engineering systems have, in fact, very large numbers of degrees of freedom and require probabilistic tools for analysis. And the way engineers typically approach these problems is they treat, you know, optimization, for example, they work on the optimization algorithms. They don't typically think about the scaling limit as n goes to infinity. You know, people are happy if they have got good algorithms that will perform well, scale sublinearly, people are ecstatic. But they are typically not asking what is happening at n going to infinity. But you know, infinity is just a very large number, as somebody once told me. So when the way n is becoming and is becoming large, it's useful to kind of analyze what happens at n equal to infinity, even though it has no practical engineering implication in some sense. So physicists, on the other hand, you know, very happy to set n equal to infinity. N was never infinity in any chunk of matter, of course. And so those tools can be brought in to analyze these engineering problems. And one interesting point that several people have made is that even though in your specific problem, the parameters are not random, you know, you're learning, for example, a network from data, the settings are not exactly random, but you can pretend they're random and get away with it, at least in terms of analyzing the algorithm. So I give you some optimization algorithm and you analyze its performance. Of course, you know, it's some airline trying to sell you a ticket, and so there are very specific parameters in there. But you're just going to pretend those parameters are random and be able to analyze the performance of those optimization algorithms. And I would point out that this is, of course, not unfamiliar in physics at all. For example, the assumption of random Hamiltonian matrices to analyze the statistical property of nuclear energy levels. But, you know, very useful trick in analyzing these algorithms. And here's sort of an idea for me, which is that brains are distributed in noisy networks. I don't think anybody would dispute that. You know, a given neuron doesn't have a lot of communication capacity. There's no homunculus sitting somewhere, like a huge bandwidth channel to every neuron and observing, right? So Descartes' homunculus doesn't exist in the brain. Very, very strong communication costs. And, you know, noisy, we can debate how noisy, but it's clearly noisy. But under what conditions do distributed noisy networks perform tasks reliably and accurately? So I'm going to present you two case studies, one of which you may not have thought about, one of which is much more, you know, familiar to at least some of you. And they're relatively simple problems. One is distributed addition, and Bassam just arrived at the back, so I'm going to talk about the so-called network consensus problem a little bit in this large n limit. And the other one is the feature selection problem. So typically one has many, 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 many features to do regression on nowadays. You want to predict somebody's going to get cancer, you know, okay, there's a million things that could predict that. Which of those million things are actually important? Which features are important? So there's something called a feature selection problem, and there are some celebrated algorithms in the literature which people have studied. I'm gonna kind of make a little bit of connection to what's going on today in biology in terms of neuroscience and actually molecular biology. We are living in kind of an era of parts lists. So I don't know if you're following this, but a lot of money is being poured into this idea that to understand complicated systems, us, you know, humans, we are just going to make a long list of all the parts. And the argument is given that, well, if you're an engineer, you sort of need a parts list. I kind of have some problems with this argument. You know, I take all the parts of a car apart, laid down on the ground, and bring someone in, give them a long list. Have they understood how the car works? I'm kind of skeptical about that. You don't even know which part is important in any way. One sort of has to have some idea of what the car is doing. but this idea is there, and it can get people very focused on individual nodes, if you want, of the network. Really drill down on that one neuron. How can I get at that one neuron, one type of neuron. And as we know, qualitatively different phenomena can happen at large n. So people talk about this in terms of quote-unquote emergent phenomena, a phrase that I intensely dislike because it sort of sounds mystical to me. I think of collective phenomena. But let me just put a couple pictures up for you to keep in mind. So this is a picture of Hurricane Irma, not so long ago, 200 miles an hour, it's 90 meters per second, but you compare with the RMS speed of nitrogen molecules, it's actually a very weak correlation at the level of looking at the individual molecules, right? So this is what Hurricane Irma looks like macroscopically, this is what it looks like microscopically, right? 4% correlations. Here's a tiger jumping to catch a bird. If you, okay, these are not measured in the brain of the tiger. This is a monkey sitting in a chair doing some task in repeated trials. But this is, you know, kind of the neurons firing away and different trials. It kind of looks like this noisy, weakly correlated pattern down at the level of the individual neurons. And I would say, well, this is like this, but if you stare too much at this, you're kind of missing this. And of course, people study this level, and people study this level. It's kind of difficult to bridge. People say various things, you know, there's modeling and so on and so forth, but that's where there is this kind of idea that if you have weak correlations, some structure, but really a lot of variables, then interesting things can happen the equivalent, if you want, of thermodynamic behavior. It's not thermodynamic behavior literally. Some people literally talk about free energy in the brain. I mean, okay, if you're interested in the temperature of the brain as a physical object, that's interesting, but people talk about, you know, take fMRI images and talk about this kind of, I don't know, nonsense, frankly. I'm gonna get into trouble and lose funding. But so I'm not trying to make a literal analogy, and this kind of talk has been there before. So one has to be careful, but I think the way to study it is not to study the brain, but to study engineering problems. Because there is no ambiguity of what problem is being solved. There is no real debate about when you have succeeded in understanding something. You can go to an engineering conference, they'll tell you. And that's a better place to engage. So, okay, I don't need to convince you about the water phase diagram. One thing I would point out is, in some sense, the network is left the same. The interaction rules between the different molecules is exactly the same. You're changing some kind of global parameter, temperature, average kinetic energy, and you're observing these phase transitions. And that's why it's relevant for understanding engineering systems or brains. You're not going to change the whole network architecture in order to observe these phase transitions, otherwise it wouldn't be meaningful. And I just want to point at the numbers. So this is sort of how numbers of websites have been growing. This is the interesting thing to look at. Size of IP traffic in 2016 from Cisco is zettabyte. So people are running out of acronyms. So I'd like to point out that a zettabyte is a milli Avogadro. So instead of, you know, talking about yottabytes, let's talk about Avogadro number, because that's actually what it is. You don't need those other acronyms. And yes, you know, we are, okay, now maybe one shouldn't talk about the aggregate of all the bits on the internet, doesn't mean anything, but the numbers are large. So phase transitions have, you know, been very important in the history of physics. You're all very familiar with this, I'm not going to elaborate on it. But what may not be so familiar is that in engineering also there's been a history of phase transitions, a little bit delayed from the history in physics. And the connections have only more recently been recognized better, but it's been there. You know, my favorite, and it's a consequence of having many variables. So there's some common mathematics. Phase transitions are not physics phenomena, they're mathematical phenomena. They appear in physics and help understand certain things, but they also appear, if you want, in engineering. And my favorite example is from Shannon's error correcting codes, where you get this sharp transition between transmission with no error and transmission with error probability 1 when you cross the threshold, which is the channel capacity. Certainly in computation, some of you must be familiar with the computational phase transitions, sort of easy phase transitions that were studied in the 1990s. At the same time, machine learning examples and communication network examples were studied. I actually worked on some of that myself. I will talk about a little bit. Distributed control theory is perhaps a little more recent. And this is work I was doing when I was back at Bell, understanding phase transitions in communication networks. And this was not a performance phase transition, this was a fairness phase transition. So there was some parameter. If you tuned it, the system went from being in an unfair situation where some people just couldn't make calls because they were always being jammed by other people living on a sublattice that was always being able to make calls, kind of an antiferromagnetic model. And then, of course, as an engineer, you don't want that to happen. So you want to understand where that phase transition boundary is and stay away from that phase transition boundary. So with that kind of preamble, let me talk about a couple of specific things. So this is one case study, and this is joint work with Bassam. And this started as a conversation many years ago when Bassam visited New York and told me that he's been working on this car platoon problem, which is essentially, so we are in the era of self-driving cars. This is no joke. Your cars, you'll all be reading newspapers, the cars will be driving themselves, each car trying to maintain a distance from the next car by using some combination of cruise control and radar ranging. And the question is, could you keep this whole car formation tight? So you've got like a one-dimensional lattice of cars. Of course, there's some jitter, there are bumps on the road, and you know your engine has some noise in it. Will this formation remain intact with local control laws? And of course, my initial reaction was, of course, cannot be. One dimension cannot be long range order. And Poisson says, why? This is not a physics problem, it's an engineering problem. Well, so then we got into a discussion and of course, quickly agreed. And then Poisson converted that into like a theorem-like statement that the control theory is like that, yes, you cannot have order in a one-dimensional array of cars. And so that's published in this paper. And I'm also going to talk about distributed addition in the same context. So let me set up this particular problem. Addition is the simplest computation one can think of doing. I give you n numbers. All I ask you is just give me the mean value, add them up. But I put a constraint on you. I say that you're not allowed to use a central processor. So your xi variables will live on the nodes of a graph, which is not fully connected. They're connected by some edges. And you're only allowed to communicate along those edges. So you cannot talk to a node that's far away until you have hopped through all those edges. And I'm going to say that each node has a little bit of drift. So a practical problem to keep in mind would be network time. So you've got a bunch of clocks. I mean, this is a practical problem, actually. Something happened somewhere, a database transaction, a financial transaction, something to do with Bitcoin. You need to know when it happened. But you actually cannot easily find out whether two events were synchronous. In fact, you cannot because there's a finite propagation speed. And this shows up in the network in the form of this problem. So it's important to have some kind of global clock. If you could have a global clock, that'd be great. But that global clock has to be created by this consensus method because your local clock is always going to drift. Practical problem, actually true today. So it's not a purely theoretical exercise. So xit plus one, that's just diffusion. So the task is devise a controller, which means take some linear combination of the nodes that you can talk to and use that in your update at t plus one so that you can control the drift. So if you do not control the drift, of course, the variance is just going to do a random walk and grow linearly with time. Your clock is just going to drift linearly with time. And we are going to measure this quantity, which is just the variance across the network to know how tightly are my clocks coupled. If k I j equal to zero, no control, then sigma squared grows like t. What's the best that you can do if I give you some k I j's? And so just to get some idea about this, let's talk about the one-dimensional problem. And your first idea would be, well, let's just average the clocks, let's just take the mean of the local clocks. And that's just this update rule here, which we'll recognize as being simply diffusion with additive noise. And the control law is given by the graph Laplacian. Now, this may strike you as being very, kind of esoteric and useless, but I was just at the NIPS meeting here in Long Beach, and while flying back saw the Thomas Fire, so it's quite impressive, looked like a volcano. I saw this paper where, somebody's doing, stochastic gradient descent, and they have noticed that, communication is a cost, so they'd like to make this thing in a distributed way. So I don't know how many of you study stochastic gradient descent. If you don't, then, that particular detail is not important right now, but the point is that there's some data at each node, there's some parameters that have to be estimated. The parameters are global, and to estimate those global parameters, you would need to communicate centrally. So instead, could you estimate those parameters by having a distributed algorithm, a similar kind of random walk diffusion algorithm? And I noted when the speaker was giving a talk, they were using a ring topology. So this was like the highway of cars. The ring topology is, in fact, the worst topology you can use if you want this kind of distributed consensus. So this was just this year. All right, so what's the relationship between the network? So just to remind you of the problem statement, I want to study this problem here, and I'm choosing the k's. That's the rule of the game will be there's be some constraints on k's. I'm not going to allow you to talk to every node, and you know maybe I'll give you a limited amount of resource of k's, and you want to minimize this quantity sigma squared of t, which is just the variance across the network. And this is just a linear problem. You can imagine the nonlinear variance thereof. How does this relate to distributed addition? Now the control law that I have defined, which is diffusion, will leave the network mean unchanged. So if you started out with network sites with different values, their mean will remain just what it was at a as a function of time. So if the variance remains controlled, each network node will start approximating the network mean as time goes on. So you'll be able to do distributed addition. So what happens in one dimension? Well, you can work out, you know, it'll take you about 5 minutes to do yourself. If you look at the variance as a function of time and network size, you can either let the network size go to infinity first, then what happens is that the variance grows like the square root of time. So just to remind you, if you didn't have this diffusion, it would grow linearly as time, because each node would have variance growing linearly as time. So it helped you, but didn't help you a whole lot. The variance is still growing as a function of time. If you first let time go to infinity, so if you go to finite lattice, then the variance will scale linearly with the size of the lattice. So compare with the case with no control. This is just putting that in pictures just to guide intuition. So the blue is, so again, keep the clock analogy in mind. You've got a array of one-dimensional clocks, and blue is like at time t equal to zero, they've got some jitter in their in the times they are keeping. It could be just the phase. And turn on the so blue, so red is after 10 time steps, taking that parameter delta, which is half, which means you literally take the average. You know, the variance does decrease. You know, you start, each site starts approximating the mean a little better. But if you continue this iteration, the black curve is sometime later, you see the long wavelength fluctuations. The noise has some long wavelength fluctuations in it, and those are starting to get amplified. And so if you were to just look at the variance as a function of time, initially it drops because you've applied your consensus algorithm, but then it starts going back up. You know, don't take the actual, you know, it's not a, don't try to fit a square root by I. You know, this is just a little MATLAB simulation. Higher dimensions, and your, you know, network could be a fractal. What matters is the spectral dimension of the graph, which is also the return to the origin probability of a random walk on the graph. And if you first take the n going to infinity limit, then for d less than equal, for d less than 2, the variance will grow like t to the 1 minus d over 2, and two dimensions will be logarithmic, and then higher dimensions than 2, it will be go to a constant. And the reason for this can be seen quite easily by just taking a continuum in time and space version, which just is diffusion equation plus additive noise. And so you started with some initial configuration, and this initial configuration is going to be averaged out by the diffusion propagator as time goes on, and the noise is going to build up, but in some average way. This first part, there is some average value and some spatial variance, but the spatial variance is going to decrease like 1 over t to the d over 2 because you're averaging with this Gaussian. But the noise term, you get something that could potentially grow because you have to do an integral over time, and that integral basically produces this extra power of 1, so that's where the variance growth comes from. So if you want the noise variance per site is still growing like t, but you're averaging over t to the d over 2 sites, and therefore the variance is decreasing. So similar phenomena for the self-driving cars, power grid, etc. In other words, stable formations of cars are not possible on a highway for long chains of cars using local feedback control. And that's what, basically, that's your platoon of cars. It starts end up doing this. And well, locally the cars are not colliding. You know, let's say you impose some hard rule, but what you cannot prevent with a local control law is this kind of large fluctuation. Well, you can put in different constraints. So instead of having a, so I always thought of there must always be absolute velocity feedback because you have friction that will provide you absolute velocity feedback. But you can imagine that, but that's not important, and you're relying on relative velocity feedback. So the dimension at which the crossovers occur can change, of course, depending on what's in your equation. So would memory in the controller help? So thank you for asking the question. And the answer is actually no, at least theoretically speaking. In practice, it will help. So if you introduce integral control, just integration, then so I invite you to look at this other paper, which is also on archive. So the if you have no integral feedback, that's the straight line, the variance is growing linearly size. Now, there is a special case. If you have dynamic feedback in a noise-free way, then what you can do is you can recover exact position by integrating velocity. So that's a little artificial. So if you allow noise, then you still grow in the variance, but the growth is a little reduced. So essentially, no linear local feedback control law will give better asymptotic performance, and there's no real reason to believe that nonlinearity will make a difference, but that's, you know, left open as a research problem, if you like, given the spectral dimension of the graph. And so just purely topological considerations on the graph reduces performance limitations in this distributed problem. So distributed is very key. Now, you might think, well, we have GPS, you know, who cares about distributed? It's not that simple. GPS is not that accurate. So then you'll have to start worrying about what is the kind of noise that is coming from your, so I'm not going to not really go into this, but I think that, you know, there's nothing really profoundly new here from a mathematical perspective. Of course, this is all kind of simple stuff. But it's sort of a little different way of approaching the same problem. So people were focusing on, can we get the best control law? And what's the best algorithm to do that? It's a hard problem when your, you know, number of degrees of freedom are becoming large because you're solving this optimization problem and you need good numerical algorithms. So our approach was, well, if n just goes to infinity, can you have a control law at all? And the answer is no. And if you know that answer, then you can kind of work backwards. So it's in some sense a negative result that gives you some insight that the topology of the graph, the connection topology of the graph is important. And of course, what matters in particular is, you know, how a random walker would march along this graph and how often would that return to the origin, just like in physics. Then we studied multiplicative noise. So we said, okay, what would happen if there was some multiplicative noise? So imagine that you're in this network and you're trying to do addition and you are, you know, calling your neighbor using your cell phone and there's some jitter. So you're sending this number over to your neighbor, but it arrives with some multiplicative jitter. It could be even round off error. So if your distributed algorithm is round off error. And so we model that by allowing sort of a multiplicative factor in terms of the, in front of the linear control law, and worked on also jointly with the Clément Cyr. So those of us who were at Dell will remember Clément. He was there for a while, and with Bassam and with Nicola, who was here on this campus for some time. And this is what happens with multiplicative noise. If you have, this is the strength of multiplicative noise. This is what the exact conservation case. So I can put on multiplicative noise. In the without multiplicative noise, I had local conservation. I preserved the sum. If I still do that, if I force my multilinear noise to preserve the sum, I get a conserved case. And in that case, for small strength of the noise, I recover the behavior which was true for no noise. There's a regime where that is true, but then there's a strength of the multilinear noise beyond which you actually start getting exponential growth. So you get a disorder-driven phase transition, if you want. And what that means, well, so you can actually look at the network variance in this regime where it is finite, and notice that the multilinear noise has kind of renormalized the strength of the additive noise. And this constant, this renormalization constant actually blows up. So it will, as you approach the threshold in this red curve, this blows up and you start essentially getting exponential growth. And exponential growth is a characteristic of the variance, I should emphasize, by the way. If you look at the full distribution, these distributions are, you know, these bizarre distributions with, you know, very, very long tails, and most probable value can still be zero, but you can have infinite variance. So you recover the properties of, 5 minutes left. I was somehow thinking of a 1 hour talk, so I'm going to have to skip the second part of my talk. All right, so let me, okay, we worked out the average conservation case as well. There is some phase transition, and the important part of the phase transition is that the transition happens at zero multilinear noise threshold. So if you're in one dimension and you're forced to do distributed addition, and you have a little round of error in the infinite size limit, I'm sorry, you cannot add. So that's kind of the what happens with median, max, mode, etc. So I'm not going to talk about lasso or elastic net, and I know there are experts in the audience about this, except to say that that's a well-studied problem in which we did some more work. How many of you are familiar with lasso? At least, yeah. Let me just very, very quickly say that it's about solving this equation in a underdetermined limit where x is unknown, h is known, y is known, y is the number of measurements, n is the number of unknowns, and the number of measurements are smaller than the number of unknowns, which is determined by this matrix H. N is some additive noise, and so the idea is that if you put an extra constraint on by saying that some of the x's are zero, except I don't tell you which ones, but I tell you only k of them are non-zero and k is less than m, then in the zero noise limit, under appropriate conditions on the matrix H, you can actually recover x even though you have fewer measurements than unknowns, right? So, and the way you do it in a computationally efficient way is use this so-called basis pursuit algorithm, which was introduced by Dick Shirani, which says you minimize the least square sum with a penalty, which is the sum of the absolute values of x, and let lambda go to zero. Not going to talk about it, except that there's a phase diagram, and this is a good phase, this is a bad phase, there's a phase transition line, which is analytically known. The phase transition line was first worked out using combinatorial geometry approaches by Donahoe et al., and then there have been a number of other derivations of that phase transition line. So Anirvan and I, mostly Anirvan and his graduate students, developed this cavity-based calculation for calculating the phase transition line. But we also extended that to study something called elastic net, where there's an extra penalty term, and studying correlated behaviors. So not going to study about that, except to say that one thing that will interest physicists is, of course, there are different universality classes of these algorithms characterized by different exponents. And so lasso falls in a different universality class than elastic net. And mean field theory is exact because one is sort of in this infinite dimensional limit. One can calculate practically useful things. I'm going to not talk about this, but this is available as reprints. So to conclude, specifically dimension-dependent limitations of distributed control in the large n limit, analytical formulae for these phase transition boundaries. And one nice thing is, if you're coming from a physics world, we do infinite dimensional mean field theory. Well, that's actually useful for the engineering problems, because some of the problems are kind of in the infinite dimensional limit. Even the machine learning problems of feature vectors are very, very large dimensional. So in physics, you know, we don't live in infinite dimensional space, so sort of theoretical tricks. But in the engineering case, actually, you know, they are more relevant for the problems at hand. So one can do analytics, so maybe room for some paper pencil calculations. I'm going to leave you with this idea that, you know, I do think that nervous systems take advantage of this kind of phenomena in some interesting way. I don't have a specific thing to tell you about that, but I think it's more than just having a number of neurons and averaging across them, which is sort of one way people think about it. You know, one has to really think about what is it that a particular part of the brain is doing. Is it doing matrix inversion, for example? I mean, it could be, because it's solving some inverse problem, maybe. But then if it is doing that, and if we decide that it is doing that, then we know what are the best distributed algorithms to do matrix inversion. That can be studied. What are the limits to that? How do things scale with N? How do things scale with D? So that's kind of the where, you know, I would like to go with this, and like to thank my support. sorry for exceeding my time.
So regarding the car platoon problem, if the cars can communicate among each other, then I guess you have non-local interactions.
They are communicating locally.
But if they communicate non-locally, so really
globally,
actively sending information about their speed,
yeah,
then you can overcome this problem. So,
well, if you have global communications,
yes,
you know, that violates our rules.
Right. So is that the answer?
Well, you know, radio will have jitter in it, and you have to then calculate the noise that's involved. Like I said, you know, what are you going to communicate? You're going to communicate, this is my speed at this time. You know, we haven't studied that particular. So if only velocity is global versus only velocity feedback is global, we can look at that problem. But it's easy to work out, you know, the problem. Yep.
But I mean, the question really is, are the companies involved doing self-driving cars?
Is that, GPS is what, so I don't know, Basam, maybe you wanna comment, but my feeling is that then you get into managing many different cars. You probably don't wanna do that. You'll have to have agreements. Mm-hmm. You know, this sounds a little like a command economy. not going to go down very well in this economy, perhaps.
Just to follow up on that, you know, as an engineering, you know, I'm not an engineer, but a potential solution could be using a mixed strategy where you also are filtering for it. You said that the GPS signal is noisy, but you could simultaneously, you have the cars receiving the GPS signal, they could kind of filter on it, even if it's
yeah,
noisy, and use that once in a while,
right,
as correcting when the sort of your algorithm
is. This is all true, by the way. So I'm saying that there are many possible engineering strategies one could think about. I know Basam wants to say something. I just want to say that, you know, we sort of raised awareness, and this we did a little while ago, and people have sort of been following up on it. I'm not following what the latest is that has happened. We just pointed out to people, just being in one dimension and being local is a problem. So once people realize that, then of course, you know, let's see what are the alternatives. And my philosophy is, even in the simple linear case, you can put down all these scenarios. You can do paper pencil calculations. These are relatively straightforward calculations. One can analyze these different control laws. Basam, you want to say something?
So there's a small delay in communicating your velocity information, or maybe absolute position information from GPS, and you're trying to keep this formation like basically a very rigid train, and you're trying to do this control at a very fast time scale, where these small delay, even small communication delays, can actually impact the,
right,
the coherency of the entire formation. So that's really the issue with communications.
There's a question here. Yeah, sorry.
I mean, how low is your temperature? I mean, you could have still very long domains.
Yeah, I mean, that's a practical question.
Sure.
I don't know the answer to that. My sense is that the temperature can be high in some of these problems. So you're not always in a low temperature regime. I know you had a question there.
Because you looked at the an infinite limit, but in practice, maybe if the correlation length is 1,000, maybe that's enough for the engineers. So somehow looking at the finite size scaling, or
no, I think the long wavelength fluctuations are important. That's the sense I have gotten in the engineering problems. There is limited graph topology. That's first of all true. That it is not always there are communication resources limitations that prevent kind of all to all connections. And my sense is that
fifth neighbor connection that will already create correlation length that is 1,000 easily.
You may not be able to, for practical reasons, afford fifth neighbor. But you know, I think it's a practical question.
In them, right?
So you're asking a practical question, so there's no mathematical answer to it. You know, I'll have to defer to my engineering colleagues. What we were pointing out is that the engineers need to be aware of these performance limitations. And just from the response to the paper, it appears that it must constrain them in practice. I mean, I don't know if Bassam, you want to say something about it?
Just to say that the largest formation that has ever been tested in reality is 8 cars.
8 cars? So let's not get too excited about it.
Yeah. You mentioned that they take care of translational symmetries in photographs using convolutional networks.
Yeah.
And then rotations now by rotating the filters. Is there a way to take care of scaling?
Well, I was just pointing to Mallet's work. So one way to do it is to think about projective transformation. So of course the symmetry that's most relevant for the visual system is projective symmetries. You know, objects that are close versus far, they're being projected onto your retina. So, but then you get a, you know, multi-parameter group, non-abelian one to deal with. And I don't think anybody has really worked all that through. So Mallet has a little different approach. He just takes filters of different scale. So that's kind of a hand-coded way of doing it. So one comment I wanted to make, it's not just cars, by the way. The same kind of Laplacian occurs in power grids, and in the distributed stochastic gradient descent application that I was giving you, the number of processors there actually are going to become large. ImageNet, I don't know if that makes any sense to you people, were first training ImageNet, DeepNets, many months. I was just listening to a talk where they were using a distributed version to reduce that time to hours or minutes. And the number of processors involved are actually large. I don't remember, hundreds, could be thousands. And some of the asymptotics can set in by the time you've got to 100 or 1,000.
I have a question about the part that you skipped, maybe.
Yep.
Because I would be going back to when you said that you used the cavity method. In my point of view, if you have the message passing algorithm and the replica method, there is not really anything new you get from the cavity method. So what was really your
Well, first of all, I find it more transparent than the replica method. You know, there's no temperature involved. It's just the
You get the same equations at the end, right?
Yes, but in between you don't. So you get different equations in between. And it's just a sort of way of thinking about the problem that I find more intuitive. You tell somebody about the cavity method, if they're not familiar with it, first of all, they might not believe you. You know, then they need to start proving things. The cavity approach is just a little more intuitive, perhaps, even for people who are not familiar with it. It's just an iterative approach. These are all mean field theory approaches, of course. So if mean field theory works, you can approach it in 5 different ways. It'll produce the same equations.
So I guess asking differently, in terms of the results, is there something you got that was not there in the previous work?
Yes. So somehow, even the equations were there. People hadn't quite analyzed these exponents around the phase-transition boundary. I was a little surprised by that myself. Like this one here is a simple one. If you just take the basis pursuit case and you look at the mean squared error and you're on the phase-transition line, And I could not find this in the literature. It is inherent in the equations, of course. You just need to expand them. But you get the regularization parameter to the 4/3 power. So that I did not see in the literature, even though this is a 20-year-old literature. And as opposed to elastic net, where it is just lambda, so you see the exponents differ. Elastic net, the actual equations were not written down in the literature for some reason, even though, you know, we sent it somewhere, the referee said, well, it's kind of an easy consequence. You could write down the elastic net equations, but nobody had done that. Again, the mean squared error, if you are very close to the phase transition, the regularization parameter goes as the 2/3 power of the noise variance. So these non-integer powers, haven't seen that, you know, all literature, but people haven't analyzed it in that way.
Does that depend on the signal, or is that universal with respect to your x,
x? So there are some conditions on x, but, you know, relatively benign conditions. Of course, you know, you can, if the distribution of x near zero, you know, actually is zero with some gap, then you get very different behavior, or if it is going to zero. But if it's a constant, if around zero you've got some density of x, then those results will be true. Otherwise, exponents change. You know, if you've got a gap, then you get exponentials. If you have got a power law, then you get a different exponent. But as long as the distribution of non-zeros is constant around zero, that's, you know, it's not completely universal, but, you know, it's some class of probability distributions. Another thing that I should point out is that with correlated entries, so there were some results in the literature, but we didn't find a really transparent analysis of it, even for the, you know, very sparse limit. So if you get correlations, you need more measurements. And so we are able to...
Correlations in the...
H matrix. And so I believe that was a new result, that for specific cases of correlations, we are actually able to calculate the phase transition boundary moving away from the uncorrelated case. And in real life, of course, there's always correlations in your measurement.
Maybe we should take it offline.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is not, we did this as a warm-up exercise. This was not, we realized that this problem has been studied for a while. But because it's studied a little differently, you know, there were various things that we didn't find in the literature, and we found the cavity method to be, I don't know, a little more intuitively plausible.
Okay, I think it's time to stop, and we have the coffee break, and I tell you again that there has been a change in the program, so Jean Sedna is the next speaker, right after the break, so we reconvene at 10:30.